Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, more than half of the United States is in the grip of a drought, and the summer's hot, dry weather has been tough on farmers and water systems in Kentucky, especially the western half of the state, and across Indiana, where the whole state is under a water shortage warning and residents are being asked to voluntarily conserve. Joining us to talk about the effects of the drought and what to expect the rest of the summer are Tom Pretty, agricultural meteorologist at the University of Kentucky, and Gregory Hall, who's been covering the drought for the Courier-Journal. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hi, Tom.
For inviting me.
Tom, let's start with you. I guess it depends on where you are, but I've heard some dire comparisons here. Some have said it hasn't been this bad since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. How bad is the drought here in Kentucky?
Well, let's put it in perspective. Let's take one station in the western part of the state, Paducah. So far this year has had 12 days with temperatures at or above 100. That compares very similar to what happened in 1988. You go back to 1930, 1934, 1936, they had a total of 100 days where the temperature got to or above 100 degrees.
So it's bad.
Yeah.
This goes without saying. What crops are especially susceptible to drought, and what are those that can kind of withstand the hot, dry conditions?
Yeah, anything that's shallow-rooted, Rick, like lawns, as an example, responds very quickly to a departure from normal or a quick rain. And you can see that recently, the rain that we've had across the central bluegrass and east over the last 5 days. Things have greened up. However, as you mentioned, the west has not received that rain. So corn, as an example, has taken a particularly bad hit this year, because not only because of the drought, but also because of the very hot temperatures. Soybeans, however, which can be a little more deeper rooted, the rains may help get that going again. Tobacco, which has a deep tap root, may come through this okay. It's a tropical plant anyway. So, and then of course our livestock has really had a tough time with the drought and the high temperatures.
So, what are we looking at in terms of the corn crop? Is quite a bit of it devastated?
You know, we have a lot of farmers that have switched over to trying to cut that for silage, corn for hay. And, of course, we have to be very careful in this kind of a weather pattern with the nitrate levels in that corn. That can be very toxic to feeding that to livestock. However, west and central probably won't have any corn crop. It's just been that tough of a drought. Central, our specialists here in the UK College of Agriculture say there may be some fields that have made it through the reproductive stage and will benefit from the rain, and soybeans also. So it would be west and central where the worst hit areas are.
Mm-hmm. Greg, you've been out talking to some farmers. How have they been coping with all this?
I think Tom pretty well assessed it. I mean, I had one farmer in Henderson County a couple weeks ago tell me that this was the first time with the warm spring that he had Memorial Day off. He had all his planting done, and, you know, there just was never any relief after that. And like Tom said, people are weighing their options, and I think a lot of people are, as you know, much as looking at the silage, are going to be relying on their crop insurance to carry them through.
Now, excuse my city boy ignorance on this, but it's just not feasible or possible to, when you get in the early stages of a drought, to haul out the irrigation equipment and try to water it yourself.
Well, I mean, they're city boy speaking here too, but Kentucky is not one of the major corn states in the nation, so you know. Percentage-wise, less of our corn probably is irrigated than some of the bigger corn-producing areas. And even, you know, one of the things I heard when I was in Henderson County was that even those that have irrigation, it was so dry that their irrigation equipment couldn't get over the entirety of the fields fast mm-hmm. enough to really keep up. The heat was just that bad. So even if you have irrigation, you're a little better off, but probably not out of the woods.
Obviously, this is going to affect food prices. When might we see the effects of that? It's not immediate, is it?
It's not immediate. It depends on what the the crop or commodity is. I mean, with livestock and beef prices, meat prices, you're seeing those higher because of the southwestern droughts of a couple years ago, and they really haven't let up, so that should just keep going. I saw something where the agriculture secretary said meat prices might come down a tad, but you know, I think most people will believe that when they see it. Other things, you know, get to the market quicker, fruits and vegetables, and those impacts are a little quicker, but generally speaking, there is a bit of a lag time.
Now, this was supposed to be a big year for corn, right? Big expectations?
Yeah, I think the figure was that this was the biggest crop planted since 36 or 37, and I may have joked with you, Tom, earlier this week that, you know, with all these comparisons to the worst drought since 1936, I hope there's not a 1937 flood behind it.
Oh, no.
Oh, right, yeah. Good point.
Well, Tom, has there been any relief? We've had some here in Louisville recently. I was, you know, looking out the window last night and my, you know, street was flooded. I think, well, we're going to have a show tomorrow on the drought, but, you know, the damage has been done. Has there been any relief recently out in the western part of the state?
Not so much west. In central bluegrass and east, in the last 5 to 7 days, we've probably got more rain than in the last month and a half. If you look at Paducah's rainfall as an example, they've had since January 1 maybe 14 inches of rain, but they're 17 inches below normal since January 1. So here on the short term, we don't have a lot of rain in the forecast. There is some scattered rain, but we're not seeing any big widespread rainfall systems come through, which we've certainly been enjoying the last few days. On the medium range, out through August 2nd, the medium range outlooks for Kentucky are above normal temperatures with near normal precipitation. And then the latest 30-day just came out yesterday is calling for August above normal temperatures and below normal precipitation. However, on the 90-day outlook, it's calling for above normal temperatures and near normal precip. The latest drought outlook is calling for a persistence and a slight expansion of the drought across the entire United States. So the outlook is not real, real positive.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. We're talking about the drought with the University of Kentucky agricultural meteorologist Tom Pretty and Greg Hall of the Courier-Journal. Well, Tom, we've had droughts for centuries, but now whenever there's an extreme weather event, some of us point to climate change. Is there any cause you can put your finger on to this weather extreme this summer?
It's interesting you say that because NOAA just put out an article indicating that we had back-to-back La Niñas in the last 12 to 18 months. And last year was one of the wettest years on record for the state of Kentucky. And it was one of the cooler years for the decade of the 2000s. What's driving a lot of our short-term weather and short-term climate right now is the seesawing back and forth between La Niña and El Niño. And we have just ended a La Niña as we moved into the spring. We are in near normal sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, and now NOAA has said that the models are indicating El Nino is going to return in a July-September time frame. Now, El Nino is the warmer episode of the Southern Oscillation, and what that does, what both of those two things do is they put out more energy. El Nino puts out more evaporation in the equatorial Pacific, and that's energy. And it has the ability to displace where the jet stream would normally be. In the spring and fall, La Niña and El Niño don't have much of a footprint. But it's summertime and wintertime that El Niño and La Niña can have huge changes on Kentucky's weather, one of which changes the number of hurricanes in the tropical Atlantic and eastern Pacific. So that's what's been driving a lot of our short-term climate for the past decade or so. And as you remember, 2005, that's the year of Katrina, and we had something like 26 or 27 named storms that year. So, you know, we hope we don't get into that kind of scenario again.
Well, let's talk about water supplies for a moment, and I want to play a piece of tape from Indiana. Yesterday, I spoke with the executive director of the Indiana Homeland Security Department, Joe Wainscott. That agency has issued a water shortage warning for all 92 counties. Like Kentucky, some areas have been harder hit than others by the drought. And really all the warning means right now is that communities, businesses, and residents are being asked to conserve water. And right now it's voluntary conservation, although Wainscott tells us some communities have had to put in place usage restrictions.
There are a number of municipal areas that have imposed some their own, based under state law, under their authority, within their jurisdiction, they've imposed watering bans on yards and things like that. But there's not a blanket restriction for the state. The warning that we've put out for statewide really is about voluntary conservation and asking everyone to step up and help us with that effort.
Tom, what's the water supply situation like in Kentucky? Are you aware of any communities that have imposed conservation measures?
It may be Somerset. Seemed like to me I heard on our state drought meeting that there were some locations around Pulaski County that may have had some concerns. But see, a lot of this rain that's occurred in the last 5 to 7 days has been bluegrass and east. So that has alleviated a lot of the situations on streams and rivers.
What are you hearing from other states, Tom? Where is it really bad, getting hard hit, like Western Kentucky?
Well, you know, I went back and looked at the Palmer Drought Index. That's the tool, the measuring tool we use for drought in the United States, and have for many, many years. We also have the U.S. Drought Monitor, which is an improvement, quite honestly, over the Palmer Drought. But I wanted to see what happened back in the 30s, and it's very similar to what happened back in the 30s, the way the drought migrated across the U.S. East to west, and then kind of merged over the entire U.S. during that time period, with 1934 being probably the peak of that. While we're nowhere near that kind of a situation, let me say this. 3 of the last 4 years have had dry spells with some degree of drought in Kentucky. And I'm not saying anything about the future. I'm just saying that right now the outlook does not look real, real positive.
All right. Well, we hope for the best for the rest of the summer for farmers and everyone else who depend on good weather for their well-beings. Thanks to University of Kentucky agricultural meteorologist Tom Pretty and Greg Hall of the Courier-Journal for joining us.
Thank you all.
We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. This fall, voters in 3 of the 7 Jefferson County public school districts will elect their school board members. 3 board members, Steve Imhoff, Larry Hujo, and Joe Hardesty, are not seeking re-election in districts 2, 7, and 4, respectively. And here to talk about how the races are shaping up is our guy on the education beat, Devin Katayama. Welcome, Devin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the 3 departing or existing members whose seats are up, Imhoff, Hujo, and Hardesty. Why are they not seeking re-election?
They just have been on the board for a long time, all 3 of them, and they just feel like now is the time to give the reins over to somebody else. On a couple occasions, Mr. Imhoff said it's time for new leadership, and he actually stepped aside earlier this year and let Diane Porter take over as the chairperson of the Jefferson County's Board of Education. He's still showing up at the meetings and placing his votes, but she is actually the acting chair. It'll be interesting to see in January when they vote for the chair, whether she really goes for that position.
These 3 have had eventful terms. I think Joe Hardesty was the chairman when the school board hired Sheldon Berman as superintendent, and now with the new superintendent, I think Imhoff was the board chair for that. And I'm going to miss Larry Hujo on the board. I covered it over the years. He was always...
He's an animated guy. Yeah. He's animated.
He would reach up and grab the microphone. I think, it's going to be something special, but he will be missed as well. Well, let's start with some of the candidates. Who's running for Imhoff's seat?
We have three candidates who have announced that they're going to be running in Steve Imhoff's seat. Two Davids, David Jones and David Kaplan, and then Melissa Roof. David Jones, that name may sound very familiar to some of our listeners. He is the former Humana chairman, and he is throwing his hat into the ring to go ahead and take over this position for Steve Imhoff. He's probably the most well-known candidate in the bunch, and he'll be going up against David Kaplan, who's an attorney. He's at a private practice. David Kaplan lives in the Highlands. He has two kids in elementary school. He's a 15-year Louisville resident. I asked Mr. Kaplan some of the issues that that he felt were he was passionate about. He said student achievement, obviously, and he wanted to take a look at the budget. He thought the $1 billion JCPS budget was somewhere he might be able to find some cost savings, and with that cost savings, maybe even be able to pay some teachers a little bit more money. Melissa Roof, she's a little less well-known. I had a hard time finding contact information for her. I haven't seen much written about her. But the two Davids are definitely competitors in this. Interestingly enough, though, David Kaplan did say he was interested in sitting down with David Jones to talk about some of the issues and talk about some of the compromise that they might be able to find. And Mr. Kaplan also said that there's already some good ideas and good programs in the district, and this was in response to the charter school question I asked him. He says to give that time and to pick out in the district what's working.
I think there are a lot of tools at our disposal to make schools very, very successful within an existing framework. So I guess that would be my first instinct is to, you know, see if we can replicate some successes rather than create a parallel school system right off the bat, because, you know, sometimes people look for silver bullets, but really the solution's already in front of them if folks can just get together and work to replicate successes based on, you know, proven success that we've already seen.
Now, and David Jones, again, the former chair of Humana's board of directors, big reputation. His wife is Mary Gwen Wheeler, who people might know as being an active member in the 55,000 Degrees program. I asked Mr. Jones why he's jumping into the race.
One of the reasons I wanted to get involved at this point is because I think that the current school board members chose a wonderful leader in Dr. Hargens, and I think that by supporting her and, you know, really sharing with the community the results of what I consider to be a turnaround challenge, the board can be, you know, can be a part of the improvement, and I want to help.
So that brings us to Larry Hujo's seat. This would be District 7. Are anyone file for that?
Yeah, District 7. We had two Davids in District 2. We have two Chrises in District 7 with a James Sexton. Just to go over, Chris Fell, that name might sound familiar. He's known for having a case against the JCPS student assignment plan, essentially, him and several other parents. He said his main goal is to abolish the student assignment plan. He thinks that there are some cost savings in doing so, and specifically with eliminating some of the buses and bus routes. And he says he's a straight shooter. I asked him also what he thought about the board's work, and he says the communication among board members isn't the best, and he talks about this thought process for working out issues himself.
There has to be an equal amount of give and an equal amount of take so that we can come to a scenario that is going to be best for everyone. And one of the ways that I like to look at things is to set up a pro and con list. And once we find out what all the negatives are, what all the positives are, we can now sit back and determine, well, we know what isn't going to work. We know what will work. Let's go back and forth and figure out what's more important as a negative, what's more important as a positive, and meet in the middle.
And Mr. Fell also said he'd like to visit schools in his district and be more active in the classroom as well. Chris Brady was the latest to file for that seat, District 7, which is the southeastern part of Jefferson County. He also received an endorsement from Hujo. So Hujo is backing Mr. Brady.
Well, that brings us to Joe Hardesty's seat in District 4, and as I guess as of this morning, no one has filed.
It doesn't seem like anybody wants to touch that seat. I'm not. I mean, I don't know why, but yeah, nobody has filed as of now. They have until August 14th to do so.
And what part of the county is that seat?
That's the western part of Jefferson County. Southwestern part of Jefferson County is Joe Hardesty's seat.
So still have a couple of weeks, actually 3 weeks or so, to file for that seat. Well, you know, there's been a lot of news coming out of Jefferson County Public Schools here in the past few years. The student assignment plan dating back to 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court overturning the former assignment plan, the complaints about long bus rides. So lots of issues that to be debated this fall.
There are a lot of issues. And it's a really interesting time, too, because we just implemented our assessments, our state assessments, and a lot of new programs that are happening around JCPS. So a drastic change to the board could shake things up a lot. So it'll be interesting to see whether the people who take over these seats work with the board or maybe they push back a little bit. It's hard to say at this point. And really quickly, one interesting thing that David Jones said to me was that he's also jumping into the race because of Dr. Hargan's hiring. He felt like a strong board, a strong leader like Dr. Hargan's is what he said, deserves a strong board.
And the other seats, they will be up for re-election, I guess, next year?
Yeah, next year.
And while I have you here, first day of school just around the corner. Everything going smoothly as far as preparations?
Yeah, as far as I know, they're going all right. I believe next Monday the applications for free and reduced lunch go out, so parents should be looking for those in the mail.
All right, WFPL's Devin Kadiyamu covers education and many other topics for WFPL News. Devin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
We're going to hear another unrelated interview conducted by Devin now. While the online megastore Amazon prepares to open a major distribution center in southern Indiana, several other large metropolitan areas are also seeing generous local investments from the company. Some say Amazon is preparing for a major shift in its business model that includes next-day or even same-day delivery in these areas. Until recently, the company has avoided charging sales tax to customers in many states where there was no physical presence, but now that is changing. Devin spoke with Slate magazine columnist Farhad Manju. He wrote a column explaining why Amazon gave up its fight against charging sales tax. He explains the company has instead decided to build several warehouses to keep both states and customers happy.
The states kind of get to have more jobs. They get to have these big warehouses in their states. And Amazon gets to have these new warehouses where it can deliver stuff to people in kind of the largest metro areas in the country much more quickly than it could in the past.
And we're seeing that here in the Louisville region. Amazon is building a distribution center in Jeffersonville. They're hiring 1,000 workers, investing around $150 million. And that seems to be the growing trend with Amazon right now.
What's unusual about this is, so in the past, Amazon was always opening more distribution centers, but it tended to put them in places that had kind of low cost of labor, that were places that were very close to the big shipping hubs in the nation. So there are many kind of located next to airports that FedEx and UPS have big operations in. And the way that they saw themselves was as the kind of a hub and spoke model. So you would order something if you were in one of the populous metro areas. You would order something. Your order would go to their central system. They would send it out to you, and it would take a day or two to get to you. And that was a very economically efficient situation. Now they're building stuff that's right next to you. It's going to get to you much faster. In exchange, you're essentially going to have to pay sales tax on the item, where in the past you wouldn't have.
But that's a compromise that Amazon believes will work in its favor.
They think they're going to be competitive with physical retailers who also have to charge you sales tax because it's going to be vastly more convenient to order something and then kind of get it later that day or the next day.
What you're kind of arguing in your article is that even if they attach, let's say, a $5 shipping fee for next day or upgrade, I should say, for next day or same day even delivery, that people might be more willing to pay that $5 than actually make a trip to the store, and then they'll still get that product delivered right to their home instead of having to make that trip to the store.
Yeah, I mean, it, for a lot of people, I think that especially if you order a big item, if you order a television, if you order a computer, something that's, maybe several hundred dollars, the $5 is not going to be a big added expense. And it's going to save you the hassle of going to the store and buying that item, especially if it's something is the same everywhere. Like a computer that I buy from Walmart is the same as a computer that I buy from Amazon. If it's something like, apparel, if it's something that you need to physically touch and try on before you buy it, that's different. But I think that for many purchases, we could find ordering something from Amazon and getting it delivered the same day for an extra fee or the next day for no extra fee, could be the kind of the wave of the future.
Now, how long has Amazon kind of been planning this new business model or this change in a business model? Has it been ever since they've been challenged by states to start collecting the local sales tax, or how does that work?
Well, I think it's an I don't think it's a sudden shift. No, I think it's an evolution of their business strategy. So they've been going faster and faster on shipping for a long time, and they've made shipping cheaper and cheaper, and it's just sort of part of their evolution. They've just constantly refined their infrastructure to make shipping cheaper, faster, and this is the logical next step. And they have some places around the world, in Tokyo, in parts of Europe, and in their home city of Seattle, where they already offer same-day shipping. The rates depend on the item you get and kind of where you are. But they've offered it in some places, and I think that it's proven to be a popular service. And so we know that they can do it, and now it seems like they're going to slowly begin rolling it out to people everywhere else.
I imagine small businesses aren't too excited about this, but any word on any kind of response by the small business community?
Each time Amazon has made one of these sales tax deals, the business associations for small businesses and for physical, for big box retailers, have always said that this is good for them, that they think that once Amazon begins collecting sales taxes, that they're going to be on equal footing with Amazon. I don't think that many businesses have kind of realized the implications of Amazon, that in kind of return for collecting sales tax, Amazon will be much closer to the same customers that they're fighting for. I should say, too, that a lot of people are afraid of what's going to happen to small businesses because of this, but I think that Amazon is not gunning for small businesses, and small businesses aren't the ones that should be really worried about this, for the most part, because Amazon and small businesses are kind of in very different businesses. Amazon sells commodity products, and it doesn't offer the kind of personal service that you might get from, your neighborhood boutique retailer.
Right.
The real kind of target for Amazon is stores like Target and Walmart and your local supermarket and Best Buy, big box stores where people don't really feel like shopping in those stores is really a great experience. And Amazon feels that it can improve upon that experience, especially if it offers something like same-day shipping.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
That was Slate Magazine columnist Farid Manju speaking with WFPL's Devin Katayama. You're listening to Byline on WFPL.
I don't know quite how to tell you this, but you are about to see a Palomino horse named Butterscotch drive a 1960...
That's a familiar voice for many Louisvillians. It's Barry Burnson, of course, a longtime feature reporter and anchor, most recently at WDRB. He was previously on the air at Wave and WHAS-TV. Burnson retired last year, and he has a new book out about his life and career. It's called Burnson's Corner. He sat down with WFPL's Gabe Bullard to talk about the book, The Changing Business of TV Feature Reporting, and where he sees TV news heading.
I want to start by playing you a sound to see if it's something that that you recognize at all.
I would say, Gabe, that that's either a 2-horsepower chainsaw or somebody named Homer Lester imitating a 2-horsepower chainsaw, and he's the only person I've ever met who could do that.
That is Homer Lester, someone that you did a pretty notable story on in your career.
Back in the 80s, I did find Homer Lester down in Casey County, Kentucky, and immediately when he performed some of his internal combustion engine imitations over the phone, I said, "We'll be there in the morning," and we were.
And these types of stories were once a very big part of TV newscasts.
Well, you don't see them as much anymore in one sense, but you do see them more in a different sense. There are so many more people with video cameras now shooting unusual things that happen, and those instantly make it onto television stations and to television networks. But what I think they represent, whether they were done as formal features or just, gee whiz, look at this video, is a side of humanity that we often ignore for the screaming headlines and the publicity seekers, and to be able to find you know, ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You know, I think that that gives a complete picture of American society, or really any society.
Do you think that features have gotten weaker over the years on television?
Well, I don't know about weaker, but, you know, there are no longer very many reporters who are dedicated to them. As I said, you know, you can turn on a television channel almost any hour of the day and see some wacky video, you know, Brits chasing a ball of cheese down a hill, let's say. But there is no journalist to interpret that for us. And I think that's kind of the problem with a lot of news today. You can go on the Internet and learn lots of things. Some of them are even true. But it's very difficult to tell, you know, what is just public yammering and what we have paid journalists to do for centuries, which is to be gatekeepers, to interpret them, to tell us why something is important or impactful or interesting.
Do you feel like, had you stayed in print, because you started out writing, that you might have a much different reputation? There are a lot of columnists out there in the newspaper world or in the print world doing something similar, and it seems like they earn a bit more respect than the TV reporters doing it.
Well, I think one of the problems is that television news comes out of the same box that brings us, you know, the those execrable reality shows and, you know, all sorts of chaff. So it's hard to separate the wheat sometimes because it all does come out of the same box. Of course, you could say the same thing about Dave Barry, who comes in the same newspaper that, you know, important world news comes in. But I don't know that there's a hierarchy. One of the problems with television, and to a lesser extent radio, is that it's a very personal kind of reporting. People see you associated with the story you're telling. In a news feature, in the newspaper, you don't see that reporter, and so it's kind of a hard line to straddle, if you will. You have to bring your own personality to the reporting, but yet you don't want to get in the way of the story. You want to get out of the way of the story if you can, and seeming to do that is part of the interesting challenge in feature reporting.
That is something else you mentioned, and when you watch your stories, there isn't as much of you in them. Nowadays, you see a lot of television reporters, locally and nationally especially, who seem to want to be the focus. They want to be on camera. They want to be the one known as the one who's doing the story, where with a lot of yours, you're quite literally on screen stepping away, stepping out of it.
True. And consultants who have been hired to run Not to run, excuse me, I think that was a Freudian slip. Consultants who have been called in to help TV stations increase viewership have for years said the reporter cannot be a mystery voice. You have to put the reporter in the story. Reporters have to be identified with the story. And you'll see a local reporter now appearing three times in a story, the beginning, the middle, and the end. You know, I've resisted that because I don't think I'm the story. You know, if you remember me, I'll have succeeded as a personality, but I'll have failed as a storyteller.
What are your thoughts on the state of TV news now?
Well, gee, there's more of it than ever, isn't there?
There is. It's every few hours from 4 a.m. to midnight.
Yeah, and it probably won't be long until here in Louisville and a lot of other markets you'll see a 24-hour news operation. Well, you know, when I started in television, it was before the accountants realized that news was the profit center of the station. Once they did, then we, of course, increased the amount of news. I'm not sure it has gotten better. The technology certainly has, you know, just gotten phenomenal. You can do a live report on camera from almost anywhere in the world on your phone. You know, this was a dream in the days of alligator clips and, you know, trying to do remotes that way. As the technology has increased, though, I'm not sure the quality has. There are still good reporters. There are still good news operations. You just have to take them with a bit of a grain of salt, and you have to be able to distinguish, as I said before, between the roar of the crowd, which is so apparent on the Internet, and what trained journalists do.
Do you think with so many local newscasts there's room for a front-to-back quality newscast on local television?
Well, you could say the same thing about local newspapers. You know, is the newspaper filled every day with things that you absolutely have to know or would be interested in? And the answer is no, not every day. But there are some days when, you know, big weather events, let's say, or a major news story, you would want to have almost a constant flow of information. You know, it's I think, educational to remember that this city, Louisville, excuse me, used to have four newspapers, and now there's one. We have four television stations that do news. It's possible that the accountants will say, you know what, we could make more money if we put on, you know, Balinese gong music for an hour a day instead of news. And when that happens, that news will go away. It's not a given that there will always be four news operations on television in Louisville.
You watch The Newsroom?
I have watched it twice and have not felt compelled to watch it anymore.
That was Barry Bernson, who has a new book out called Bernson's Corner. Of course, you probably remember him from WDRB, where he was most recently an anchor, and also his work at WAVE and WHAS. You can see some of Barry Bernson's features from over the years on our website, WFPL.org. Coming up in our art segment, Aaron Keene will talk with filmmaker Archie Borders, who's starting production here in Louisville on his latest project, Pleased to Meet Me. The cast of the movie, based on the story from This American Life, includes Amy Mann, Loudon Wainwright III, and Joe Henry. And we'll talk to him in just a moment. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this is the segment we devote to the arts and arts-related happenings, and Aaron Keene is here with filmmaker Archie Borders to talk about his new project getting underway here in Louisville. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks, Rick. Hi, Archie. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. So Pleased to Meet Me is a film based on one of a classic episode of the radio show This American Life that was devoted to one day in the classified ads. We have Ira Glass's intro to the segment.
It's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. If you're just tuning in, all this hour we're bringing you stories that we got from the classified ads that appeared on just one day, August 25th. In the Chicago Sun-Times and in the Chicago Reader that same week. You know, often with the classifieds, you'll come across an ad where somebody is looking for something, and then practically right alongside that ad, there is somebody else who is offering the very thing that that person is seeking. You've seen this? This seems to be especially true in the musicians' classifieds. You'll see guitarist looking for drummer, and then right there, you'll see drummer looking for guitarist, right on the same page. It's kind of heartbreaking, really. So we got to thinking, what if somebody were to play matchmaker for all of those people and do what all of us think when we see those ads? Well, our producer, Starley Kine, recruited John Langford of the Mekons to do just that, to go through the classifieds and create a band culled entirely from the classifieds, to play together for exactly one day, long enough to gather together in a recording studio to record their one and only song.
So, Archie, your story, very similar, based on this American Life segment.
Yes, very similar. And it was one of those stories that it's, what do they call it, the driveway moments when you can't stop listening. It was literally one of those kinds of things.
And so what attracted you to this story with all of the compelling stories out there to write an original screenplay based on?
Oh, wow. Honestly, the thing that was the most appealing, if you've ever worked on a film or a stage play or an art opening or whatever, is those moments where you get all these people together from, you know, all sorts of backgrounds that you may never, ever see again once that thing is over. And making a film is a lot like that. So when I first heard that story, and it's such a sweet story, and it's kind of got this bittersweet ending that we had to change for the movie, actually, but it's just one of those things that, you know, it kind of resonates on a personal level, like, oh, this was just that kind of day, one of those great days you're never going to have again.
So you have a great cast of actual musicians.
We do.
Playing musicians, yes, in the movie. Amy Mann, Loudon, yes, Wainwright, Joe Henry, John Doe. Why was it important to you to find folks for whom music was their primary career and acting is maybe a second vocation?
Well, it's a musical, so there's a lot of terrific actors out there who can play music, but the one thing about having rock stars, they're natural born performers anyway, and we just thought if we can get these guys to play these characters and play variations of themselves, the music's going to sound just a lot better than if they were faking it. Plus, you know, we got so lucky when Joe Henry jumped on board to attract this kind of talent, Amy and John Doe and Loudon. You know, John and Loudon are actors anyway. They've been acting for years and years. but also Karen Berquist from Over the Rhine. You know, people like that came on board. And, you know, just trying to replicate that anywhere. It literally, the movie's kind of turned into a real-life version of the show it's based on. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, kind of. So in the This American Life episode, the song that they all ended up playing was Elton John's Rocket Man.
Yeah.
Everyone speaks Elton John.
Yes.
Are we going to get to find out which song your cast is performing?
I can't tell you right now. It's still up in the air. There's a lot being discussed. It's one thing about radio is you can get songs a lot cheaper on the radio than you can when you're trying to make a feature film. So we're working on that right now.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So, and this isn't your first rodeo.
Nope.
You've been working in independent film for quite some time. Yeah. Paper Cuts was one of your last big projects.
Yep.
So what's it like being an indie filmmaker with big screen ambitions here in Louisville, Kentucky?
It's really hard, Erica. it's fun. It's great. The great thing is, for movies like this especially, is you'd get to make them in your hometown. But, and again, a lot of people who do films here, they have other jobs. I have a production company. I've been very fortunate that does commercials and things like that. And that's been very successful. So that's allowed me to stay here and still do the films, you know, as I can develop them. And my partner on this, Mike Fitzer, we decided a while back, you know, okay, it's time to use the company that we already have. I'm plugging it, 180, to not only produce movies, but to continue producing these commercials. So that keeps us solvent, but it lets us continue to stay in our hometown.
So is Kentucky a hospitable state for filmmaking?
It's terrific. Yeah. It's terrific. There's been a lot of efforts in recent years by neighboring states, West Virginia, Georgia, Louisiana, to offer tax credits. Mm-hmm. So it's been really difficult to lure bigger films to Kentucky. So that's been the only drawback. But, you know, shooting here has always been a dream.
So tax credits would bolster our state's filmmaking economy.
Couldn't hurt. Yeah. No, it's a tough one. It's very competitive right now. You see things like The Walking Dead down in Atlanta. It's there because of the tax credits.
Mm.
So
yeah, I hear that about West Virginia too. It ends
West Virginia's
up being cheaper.
Got great tax
shoot
credits.
There. Yeah.
Yeah.
Romania is the cheapest, right?
Awesome place to shoot, I hear. I'd love to be there.
Probably not the best for this film. Okay, so that leads us to money, to funding.
Mm-hmm.
I would venture a guess that the biggest challenges for indie filmmakers are funding and distribution.
Yes.
Like you can get the equipment and you can write a great script and you can get fantastic actors, but money and access to the film are big challenges.
Right, and it's different for every film. The last couple of films were bigger budgeted affairs, and a lot of those were made, very frankly, when the economy was better. So what we're doing on this film, part of the mission of our company is to make smaller budget films, A, because it's easier to get your money back, and B, you know, in this advent of digital technology, it's enabled us to have a smaller crew and shoot a little faster and use different formats. So we've wanted to do that, but we've raised most of the money privately, but we are supplementing with Kickstarter.
Right. So you have a Kickstarter campaign going
right now.
Right now. Live. You can.
Yes.
If you contribute, so your film is funded, and yet we have a Kickstarter campaign here that has a goal of $44,000 additional dollars for the budget. You're at about $6,000 right now, 21 days to go, not too shabby. And so what does the Kickstarter help fund then?
It does a couple of things. First of all, again, when we started the film, we didn't expect this level of talent. Not that we weren't excited about the film, but we thought we might get one or two, you know, pretty big names. And then all of a sudden you got six or seven. And so at that point you go, we've got to do a soundtrack that's A, represents the film well, but B, it can become a money-making opportunity as well. So a lot of the money will go towards that end. But the other part of it is, like you said, you know, growing up in Kentucky, it's tough to get on films. And a lot of times when you're on films, you're asked to intern, which is fine for a couple of days.
That means work for free.
Exactly. And you know, I remember when I first got out of film school, I was all hot and ready to go and couldn't wait to get on a film set. And the first, you know, I walked up to the AD and she says, go get me a pack of merits and some poster boards. That was her first thing. And, you know, of course you're like, sure, I just want to learn. Yeah.
God,
so
absolutely.
You do that. But after about 3 days and you're working 16 hours, you're kind of like, I'm still getting, bottom line is I want to pay PAs. Yes, you can get great experience, but frankly, when you pay people, you get better results.
Absolutely.
And it's a tough economy. I want people to make some money, and we want to supplement our crew Very frankly, a lot of these guys are going to be working with the talent because, you know, we need people to take them around, and we want to supplement some of our equipment package, and we want to hire more people and give them on-set experience. And I do a program teaching for St. Francis High School, an artist in residence program, and I'm putting out all these students every year who want to be filmmakers. No better way to be a filmmaker than get on a set, get paid for your summer. That's another impetus behind it.
Archie Borders, job creator.
Yeah, yes.
So folks can
it's
go
all on, humanitarian.
Folks can go on to Kickstarter.com and yes. contribute to the film, help get some young, hungry, young aspiring filmmakers some paid jobs. It's a great thing. So, you know, when you were talking about low-budget movies that have a soundtrack, that are musicals mm-hmm. also, I think of Once, and I think of how yes. what a sort of a sleeper success that film turned out to be. And then that turned into, you know, a great sort of musical act with the Swell Season that they were able to tour on.
It's a whole franchise now. It's on Broadway.
Right,
it's like,
right.
wow, you know.
Do you think you're putting, will your dream team do some live dates? Are they going to play after
You just never know. Certainly, you'd love to see that happen. It was a very similarly budgeted film as mm-hmm. ours. So, and I do think talent-wise, we're certainly in the same vicinity. But you know, at the end of the day, the film's got to be good, and it's got to touch people. And we'll get the film made and the soundtrack done first, and we'll see what happens. If we're on Broadway a few years from now, I'd love it. But I can't, you know. Right now, we've got August 27th looming. We've got a lot to do.
So Joe Henry's doing the soundtrack.
Yes, he is. Which, again, super, super excited about.
And for folks who are mainly interested in this project because of the This American Life connection, Starlee Kine, who produced the original segment, is going to make an appearance.
She's got a cameo in the film. And one other thing I want to mention very quick, mm-hmm. and we're thrilled about Starlee being in it. Yes, we've got this national talent in, but we've also got local talent. And part of the band in the film will be played by local people. One of our cast members is Katie O'Brien, who used to be with the band Slow Break, and she's got a major role. So it's not just, hey, we've got all these established people. We're hiring locally, too, and we still have a couple other parts to fill, so those will be local musicians.
Fantastic. Did you guys hear that?
Yeah, it is.
So you're starting filming August 27th yes. here in Louisville?
Here in Louisville, yeah.
Any locations you can let us know about ahead of time? I remember all of the, like, I just saw Orlando Bloom and, you know, Heine Brothers when Elizabethtown was here.
Yeah, you know, I do want to plug it when we start shooting because where we're shooting I'm really, really excited about because I probably shouldn't say anything right now just because we got to work a few things out in terms of, honestly, we don't want a crowd to show up the first day. So we got to be a little careful about that. But it's a terrific facility. It is a local, and it is a local business, and it's locally owned. So it's going to support some local people.
Fantastic. Yes. I love the local. Mm-hmm. So pleased to meet me. Pete Jones was a 90s alt singer, and he is looking for a comeback. So who's playing Pete, our star?
That's John Doe from X.
Gotcha.
And if you've ever seen him, he's fantastic. He just finished the June Carter Cash biography that shot in Louisiana because of the tax credits, that Allison Anders, who's a Kickstarter donator to our thing, directed, and he's playing Pete.
Great. And then Amy Mann is playing his producer.
He's playing his old love, yeah, who's come back into his life. It's pretty, I can't wait to see what those two look like on camera.
And so that's one way you can kind of up the stakes to take something that makes a great 15-minute This American Life segment and
right.
turn it into something that has a high enough drama to sustain a feature-length film.
Exactly. I mean, the original piece, you know, Starlee and John Langford mm-hmm. from the Mekons, they didn't fall in love and break up and do all that stuff. So we had to kind of like, let's make up some new stuff. So there's an element of that in ours. It's also a love story and some other things going on.
Theremin player?
There is a theremin player. That's Loudon Wainwright.
I love that. I love that story. I think every film should have starring Loudon Wainwright as a theremin player.
There's going to be a cameo by his son Rufus, and I can't explain how, but it's going to be cool too.
Will Ira be in the film?
He's in the script. So if he doesn't, it's going to be, you know, Myron Bass or something. But yeah, we're hoping Ira will play himself at the end. He's supposed to. We'll see how it works out.
Great. And so then the plan is after it's cut and edited festivals, theatrical release?
You never know. Again, we would love to premiere at something like a South by Southwest. Would love to do the Flyover Film Festival here in town. Again, local. You never know theatrical life, what that will be like. We hope to be theatrical. We'll see.
Great. Thanks a lot, Archie.
Yep.
All right. Aaron Keene with Archie Borders. Archie, good luck with the film. We look forward to hearing about it as you go along. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information on topics addressed on Byline, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a great weekend.
is it?